Yes, okay. So thank you for having us again. Today's theme is energy markets. Myself and John Birch will be talking about some applications in this area. Okay, so this is an outline of the talk, and for some reason the screen is a bit wider than it appears on the computer screen, so you may have some difficulty reading, so I apologize. But I will give a brief introduction to the energy market. I don't expect the audience to know, except we use electricity, how it's generated, how it's traded, and other related issues. Okay, so I'll spend a good amount of my time talking about energy markets and the different elements of these markets. An important event that took place in the U.S. in the early 90s or late 80s is the deregulation of the market. And this triggered lots of research and activities since we started to have energy trading. So I'll describe the deregulated market briefly. Then I'll have a long laundry list of opportunities or problems where people with backgrounds in optimization, statistics, computer science, mathematical modeling in general could use their skills to apply them to these problems. If you open any technical journal, most of the articles talk about trading, some game theory, but there are many other interesting problems outside the scope of trading that are of great interest. Within IBM Research, I was telling Tamash, I cover the energy industry, and I get at least 2 calls per week for things where I didn't even think about the problem itself. So I'll show some of these problems. Then, if I have the time, I'll touch briefly on some work I've done with a colleague of mine on the robust modeling of short-term electricity contracts, and I'll describe the problem when we get into it. These are what we call two-stage stochastic linear programs, but they have integer variables in the first stage, so I'll touch on the issue of how to solve these problems efficiently. These problems, by the way, arise in the daily clearing of the market, so there is some time requirements on doing the calculations fast, and this was the main idea behind this effort. So there are 2 goals for this talk. The first one is to describe the market, the second one is to provide an application, and if I achieve the first one, which is making the audience interested in some aspects of this market, I would consider it a good talk. So let's talk about the supply chain of electric power, all right? These are the basic components of a power generation system, and I apologize, I know some people in the audience here know this stuff pretty well, so I apologize for that. It starts at the power generation, that's the manufacturing facility where you put in some fuel into the generator, and from that you produce energy. Now, again, the generator is a complicated thing, but this is a simple description of how things are run. You produce heat, whether it's nuclear, coal, gas, etc. From that you create steam, you have a shaft that spins, and then you go into an alternator, you produce electricity. It's exactly what you saw in your physics 101 lab. It's not complicated. Of course, to get an efficient energy output, you have to do lots of complicated things to get the energy. When it's produced, it goes over the power lines into what we call transmission. So there are 2 components. There is transmission and distribution. When you go over the high voltage power lines, it's called transmission. And by the way, after the power is produced, the voltage is increased or lifted because the losses are smaller when the voltage is higher. So when you see these high power lines on the highway, this is just to reduce the losses in the system. It's shipped close to your home. The voltage is taken down, then you go into the distribution, which is lower voltage power lines, and there are often other things on the system to maintain its reliability. Now, this is a very simplified picture. If you have an industrial customer, like let's say Ford Motor Company, they may have their own system where they take it from the transmission into their own consumption. Some IBM plants, for example, they have their own transformers to take the power from high voltage, take it down to a low voltage. Right, that's the overall picture. Now, although it's a simple picture, there are many interesting elements to it. The first one is operating the power plant itself. Often we assume, if you look at mathematical papers, people assume that the production of the power plant is a curve that's given. So, you know, you put so much input, you get so much output out of it. Reality is the power plant itself is a very complex system. And if you look carefully at it, there are hundreds of measurements taken at each point in the plant. When I say measurements, I'm referring to the pressure of the steam, I'm talking about the heat, I'm talking about the production. All these measurements are collected, but unfortunately, nobody does anything with it. There are people, individuals, humans, who will look at it and say, you know what, it seems there is something going wrong here in this valve, and they send someone to fix it or take a look at it. A recent request that I received, and again, I have no way of addressing it, is we collect all of this data. Can we do some sort of statistical quality control that they often do in manufacturing to detect when the power plant is malfunctioning so that we can detect in advance, you know, something is wrong between these two parameters. Usually they're, let's say, linear, and now they're showing some nonlinearity. So can you do something and detect that there is an error that's going to happen in the plant? Operating the plant itself is also a tricky thing. The plant usually is given some sort of a schedule. You need to produce so many megawatt hours over the next so many days, and the schedule goes up and down, of course, to track the demand. How do you operate the plant in an optimal fashion? The plants usually, especially coal plants, you can have different sources of fuel, and the way you mix them will affect the heat output, which will affect the output of the unit itself. So to mix the coal is an interesting problem on its own. If you look, by the way, in the literature, there are coal blending problems and coal blending solutions, but they do not capture many of the characteristics of the coal. So sometimes they ignore the uncertainty. If you take a ton of coal, its output is not known with certainty. There is some distribution around that. So there are a variety of problems here. One of the most interesting problems, and John and I worked on it, which is to balance the load or supply and demand. So you have electric load at this end, and you have the production at the other end. How do you schedule the units in advance to meet the electric load? When I say schedule, each unit has a certain capacity. It could operate within a certain range. The easiest way to think of a power unit is to think of your car. It has a certain RPM. You push harder, it goes faster, it produces more energy. It's exactly the same operation. Usually a power utility has a large number of plants, anywhere from 20 to 100 or more. It depends on the utility and how sophisticated they are. And one issue they run into is they have some sort of a load forecast every hour of the week for the next 7 days or so. And the question is, how do I schedule my generating units to make sure I can meet the load? Now, the unit is, again, a sophisticated device, so you cannot switch on and off as you please. When you commit it on, it has to be on for a certain number of hours, certain number of days. Nuclear power plants, for example, they bring them on at the beginning of the season, they keep them running for 2-3 months. Coal plants, the large ones, they stay on, running for a few weeks. A smaller plant, you could switch it on and off as you need to. But to balance the future load with the demand, with the supply, is an interesting problem. Again, there are stochastic versions of it, and I will touch later on the issue of prices. The fact that there is trading in the marketplace, you do not have to produce all of your power yourself, but you could go to the market and buy some of the power from other providers if the price is suitable. This is a picture for the U.S. electricity market. And by the way, lots of this data I took from the Energy Information Administration. This is a very good website from the Department of Energy in the U.S. It's eia.doe.gov. I give the chart to Judith, and it lists the website here, but it doesn't show on the chart. This just to give you an idea of how big this industry is. Okay, this pie chart is taken from 2002. Now, there is always growth, about 1-2% per year, but these numbers are reasonably representative. The U.S. consumes about 3,000 billion kilowatt hours per year. Now, it's hard for me to describe that number other than saying, you know, these light bulbs usually are 60 or 70 watts, so you do the math. And if you want to look at it from the magnitude in dollar value, a kilowatt hour runs for about 6 cents, 5 cents, depending on where you are. So again, you do the calculation, it's a huge industry. Now, what the pie chart is showing is the different mix of fuels that are used in the U.S. Canada is significantly different, actually, and I will talk in a moment about Canada. But about 50% of the U.S. production is coal, all right? This is changing slowly, by the way. 10 years ago, about 55% used to be coal generation. And the nuclear used to be also a little bit higher. The one that's increasing is natural gas. There are lots of reasons for that. From the operational standpoint, the natural gas units are much more flexible. All right, so when you turn a unit on, and they're more advanced, when you turn it on, it can switch on and off more easily, right? So you don't have to commit for a long time period. They're also efficient. There is an important issue, which is emissions, which I'll talk about in a moment. But natural gas is a cleaner source of fuel than coal. Now, nuclear is on the decline. Nuclear is not popular, of course, for a variety of reasons, but the existing plants are retiring as time passes by, so you see nuclear is going down. The other big source of energy, reasonably speaking, in the U.S. is hydroelectric. Of course, it cannot compare to Canada, but hydroelectric are dams and reservoirs that produce this energy. It's about 6%. Renewables, again, the goal is to push for these, if possible, green energy and the like. It hasn't been very successful so far in the U.S. Now, in blue, I describe a little bit the Canadian market. So compared to the U.S. is 3,900 or, and by the way, the U.S. is about 28% of the consumption of the world. And they do that, I mean, the U.S. consumes about 30% of the energy in the world in general, not only electricity. Compared to the U.S., I think Canada has about 549 billion kilowatt hours, which is a substantial number, I felt, given the difference in population. Yes. Of course, some of that is shipped to the U.S., but it's a very small amount still. And most of the generation in Canada, I think more than 50%, happens to be from hydro units. In the box here, there is a little remark. I don't know if you can see it, but there is something called independent power producers. So again, in the U.S. and in most countries, you split the world into two types of producers. There are the typical or traditional utilities that have been producing power for a long time. Then there are people who produce power on their own, or they're less regulated. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But the interesting thing, again, these different fuels, again, they have different impacts and different political impacts, so the emissions and the like. But also from the generation standpoint, there are different constraints on these units. So nuclear is the cheapest, but it has the toughest constraint in the sense it has to stay running for a long time, a period of time. Coal is more expensive than nuclear, but still reasonably cheap, but it's polluting and so on. By the way, we'll talk about this later. Okay, this is a curve showing the price of electricity. One reason behind deregulating the energy market, there was a strong feeling that the prices of electricity are not, they vary in a wide range. Okay, so on top I show some prices. It's 4 cents per kilowatt hour in the state of Washington in the Northwest. And it's about 10 cents in the state of New York. Even within one state, the price range is rather wide. So for example, the average for New York is 10 cents, but where I live and in Long Island, you pay about 13 cents, so it's about 30% above. Some other areas, they pay 60 cents. There are different reasons for that. The fact you have differences between different states, in the case of Washington, for example, they have more hydro. Hydro is much cheaper, of course, than burning fuel and producing electricity. So that's one reason. Within the state itself, there is also supply and demand. I mean, the utilities, although they're regulated, they have certain power to get the prices in a specific fashion. Now, sometimes it's blamed on congestion in the transmission lines and others, but still the consumer sees a wide range of prices. I put here the example that the price reached $6 per kilowatt hour. So the typical price is 4 cents, 5 cents, 6 cents. I think the U.S. is 7 cents on average. In 1998, in the Chicago area, there was a very tight shortage of electricity, and the price went up about 100-fold for a few hours. Now, there was a big investigation after that, and whether Enron and AEP were playing games or not with the market. But reality is, the problem with electricity, you cannot store it. That's a very important characteristic of it. So in the case of other commodities, you store them, you need them, you use them. In the case of electricity, it has to be produced the moment the demand occurs. And this causes the price to be very volatile. If you look at the volatility of commodities, electricity has a volatility of about 60% compared to gas 40%, and I think the average of the commodity market is about 25%. So it's a very volatile commodity. One reason happens to be you cannot store it. I'm showing here the price of electricity over time, starting in 1960, and these are in $2,000. So all these numbers are normalized for the $2,000. The green line happens to be the average within the U.S. There are three sectors, by the way, the way the companies look at the world in the energy business in different sectors. There is the residential sector, which is your home, commercial sectors, which is the small shops and malls and the like, and the industrial sector. In the U.S., they're roughly speaking 30-30 each, one-third each. But as you can see from the prices, there is a reasonably large gap between what the industrial customers pay and between what a residential or commercial customer pay. Are there any questions? Go ahead. Yes, so you could always store it. You cannot store electricity on its own. You could store it in a different form. So you could pump water and release it. And this is the case in Michigan, for example. They have a big lake where they pump in and out of it. That's common. The battery is the same concept, right? You charge it and you release it. But electricity by itself cannot be stored to say, you know what, let's produce it immediately. Let's use it immediately. I agree with you. Any other questions? Feel free to interrupt. Okay, so these are the prices. Again, they fluctuate based on supply and demand in different areas. Okay, electric power and the environment. Now, this is an important subject for two reasons. In most countries, there are constraints on emissions, and I'm not an expert on emissions, but these are supposed to be very large numbers. But you have the carbon dioxide, the sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide. Okay, these are the fumes that come out of power plants and other industrial, you know, not necessarily power plants, but other industrial operations. In the U.S. and in many countries, there are regulations on how much you could emit into the air. So if you are a utility and your production is not clean, you don't have good generators, and you're producing lots of emissions, you may reach a certain cap that's often, you know, instituted by the government, or you pay certain penalties. So what many utilities do, they trade emissions with each other or with industrial manufacturers. Okay. The other interesting element is, and again, I don't know if you can read it, this in the back, electric power plants are the second largest user of fresh water in the United States after agriculture. Each day, the electric power industry withdraws 190 billion gallons of water, about 40% of the fresh water withdrawal in the nation, in the U.S. Now, these are only fossil plants, and this water is used for cooling. Now, the water itself is reusable later on downstream. If you are in a state like California, though, water is very short, and running the water and stopping it could affect the operation of the power plant. As a matter of fact, when I was at Enron, there was a proposal to schedule the water flow for agriculture and coordinate with the power plants together. It was never successful, but that's an area where it's a very important area, which is the interaction with the environment. Now, till the late 80s or early 90s, most utilities were highly regulated. Regulated meaning you have a captive set of customers, you run your own generators, you run your own transmission and your own distribution. Okay, if you are short on power, you could call your neighbor and ask for additional power. If you have a little bit of extra, you could help your neighbor. But there was really no active trading or active interaction between these different utilities. Now, there was a strong feeling, though, that electricity as a source of energy, the price of it was very high compared to other sources. Now, natural gas and oil were deregulated, and there are markets for them, so there are market prices. Electricity, again, was a monopoly, so there was a push to try to deregulate it. Before the deregulation of 1992, actually, there was another push trying to reduce the dependence on foreign oil after the 1973-1974 crunch. So the U.S. government issued an order to ask utilities or to force utilities to buy the production of independent producers. So if you have a little windmill and you produce electricity for your own use, but you don't need it on Friday and Saturday, you could sell it back to the grid, to the local utility. They buy it from you and they sell it to their customers. The problem with this proposal, of course, is the utility set very low prices to buy the power from the local producers. So this wasn't a very successful attempt. The real action took place in 1992 when the utilities were required to open their transmission systems to other producers. So in the sense, if I'm living in New York and there's a producer in Detroit, Michigan, in principle, I could contract that producer to transmit the power over the power lines of the different utilities between New York and Detroit, and we pay them a certain fee. This was further reinforced by FERC Order 889, where they established something called the OASIS system. OASIS stands for Open Access Same Time Information System. So although you own your own power lines, you are not allowed by law to distinguish your power, the power you produce yourself as an entity, from the power produced by other entities. So there was a complete separation between the production and the transportation, or generation and transmission. So you could generate and that's fine, but the transmission lines are open to everyone. Okay. On the Oasis system, if you go online and you could find some systems, there is one for PJM, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, there is one in California, you could see some numbers. But basically what it says, from point A to point B, this is how much capacity there is between the following hours or on the following days, and this is the price of this capacity. It's not this simple, but this is the overall idea. So although, for example, my local utility, which is called Con Edison, they own the power plant in the area of New York, in principle, they have to give fair access to other utilities who are trying to sell through the state of New York, through their power line. Okay. In 1999, again, this was further reinforced by FERC. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it's the government body that oversees the U.S. energy market. FERC asked to create what they call RTO, Regional Transmission Organization. Again, these are entities that look over the power lines and they coordinate these power lines. The best thing to do is, you know, if you are interested in the subject, to go to pjm.com, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland.com. This is one of the largest transmission line entities, and they have a very comprehensive website. They show prices, they show data, they show loads, etc. So it's a very nice website to go and take a look at. Now, what's of interest in the electricity deregulation, again, the prices before deregulation were more or less controlled. The activities were limited. After deregulation, utilities could buy and sell from each other and to parties far away from them, and this created a whole market and lots of opportunities for modeling. Just to get an idea how the different areas are interconnected, this is what's called NERC. NERC stands for North American Electric Reliability Council. NERC started, I think, back in the 80s. The main idea was we need to have reliable power. Again, power cannot be stored. So what happens, there is high interconnectivity between the different utility, so that if I'm short on power here, I could borrow immediately power from my neighbor through the power line. So NERC were these entities where there is some sort of control and high connectivity. And you can see it's the U.S. and Canada more or less together. I think there are 10 different regions. I'm not sure why some regions are bigger than others, except for Texas. This happens to be a political requirement, I think, by the Texas Constitution to make sure that no federal government will oversee their power lines. I think they have that in the Constitution. But the other ones, I have no idea why they're smaller or bigger. Okay, but again, the fact that these things are highly interconnected would allow the transmission of power as needed when trades take place. Now, by the way, when I talk about power trading, some of the trading is financial. So the same way you trade stock, you trade options and futures on electricity. But some of it happens to be physical. So if you decide to buy power, a contract, and you sell it before, you know, let's say delivery of a certain amount of power in the month of June, if you sell it before June, that's fine. But if you get into the month of June, you have to deliver this power somehow. You have to produce it and deliver it to the interested party. So that's my laundry list of what I think is areas where mathematics could be used to do some modeling in this domain. And I know it's not exhaustive. The top two happen to deal mostly with the operation and of the energy, so trading, production, generation, and the like. And then I'll talk about these few problems in a moment. In the long term, many utilities are interested in determining, do I build additional power plants? Do I expand in a certain area? That's a very big question for them. So demand forecasting in a specific region based on the population growth and the industrial growth in that region is an important subject. Electricity price trends. Again, this is not in the short run. We're not talking about today and tomorrow. We're talking about 5 years from today. Will downtown Manhattan have more demand or less demand? Okay, so we're looking at economic trends and population trends to affect the demand. Market design, that's a very hot subject, actually, as we speak. If you remember, there was, in 1999, we had lots of blackouts in the state of California. And people blamed that heavily on the poor design of the market in the state of California, that people could game the system. So the area of market design and using game theory and simulation to suggest different designs and how, you know, see how the market will react is an important subject. Contract evaluation. Again, many utilities enter into long-term contracts. Nobody signs a contract for 1 month or 1 day. In many cases, they have multiple-year contracts. I presume the university here has multiple-year contracts with the local utility. So how do you evaluate these contracts? Again, you have the long-term impact of prices going down or up based on technology trends or based on population growth. Do you enter into this kind of contract or not? I remember at IBM, we were given three different alternatives. Fix your price for 3 years, for 5 years, for 7 years, and we had to decide which one to use. Again, there are pros and cons for each one of them. If the prices are going up, of course, you want to freeze it as long as you can. If they're going down, you want to get out of it as quickly as you can. It's not an easy decision, though. Fuel contracts, again, most of this electricity is produced through coal and other means. And the question is, how do you structure your fuel contracts to make sure you reduce your cost and you hedge your position? Natural gas, again, is a big source of energy or growing source of energy for utilities, but in many cases, natural gas is traded heavily, so you look 1 month or 2 months. When I talk about long-term contracts, I'm referring mostly to coal. Now, another issue here is hydropower. In many cases, utilities look at 5 years or so to schedule their hydropower operations. There was a paper, I think, by PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, talking about how they do the long-term scheduling. This paper has been around probably for 10 years or so. But it's an interesting subject, how you look at the different dams and reservoirs and how the water come down and how to plan for the next 5 or 10 years. Now, short-term modeling, here we're looking at 1 week, 2 weeks, so very short-term planning. Demand forecasting. In the U.S. and I think in many countries, the demand for electricity is driven by weather, okay? So as it gets hotter, for example, in the summer, the demand goes up substantially. In the winter, it's not as bad because they use natural gas mostly to produce for heating. But demand forecasting is an important issue. If you know the demand, you have lots of information. Of course, the weather itself is impossible to predict completely, and the demand is also difficult. Electricity price forecasting. That's, I think, what many people such as Morgan Stanley and Citigroup are trying to do, which is look at the forward prices of electricity, and again, some people are smarter than others, they can do it better, and trade based on this information. The third one is managing the portfolio of power plants. Again, you could think of the power plants themselves as contracts to produce power at a specific price. So you could look at your environment as a utility, as you have your own power plants, you have the market from which you could buy, and the question is, how do I run my portfolio to maximize my profit? Of course, when I say your profits, we're talking about meeting your demand obligations, but at the same time, making sure you consider the market, for example, you consider all the other factors. Now, less popular subjects, I think, they don't have to do with producing power, but assigning repair personnel and vehicles to maintenance calls. This is a very, very big thing for utilities. A big chunk of their cost is the workforce, right? And they have a more, you know, you go on the road and you see all kinds of trucks running around with the local utility's name on them. How to schedule these vehicles is very difficult. You have some calls that you know you're going to commit in advance. So for example, there is someone who is asking, or there is something that's broken, you know you need to send someone to fix it. That's the easy one. But in many cases, you get a call, there is a storm, and there is an emergency, and they have to send repair crews. How to prioritize and how to meet all the obligations given the limited resources you have? By the way, if there is a natural gas leak, for example, it takes a priority over other things because it may cause an explosion. Determining optimal inventory. And when I talk about inventory here, I'm talking about inventory of parts. I'm surprised that it came. I was talking to three big clients, and the three of them came up with exactly the same problem. Each power unit generator is more or less unique. It's not perfectly unique, but it's reasonably unique. Each utility maintains a good amount of inventory just in case the power plant fails or some component breaks down. The question is, which inventory should I keep? You have one of two options. Either you keep the inventory in place or you order it from the manufacturer. If you order it from the manufacturer, it takes a week or two or however to provide to you. If you keep it in your own inventory, it's costly to maintain. Of course, if something goes wrong and you have it in-house, you can immediately fix things. If you're going to order it, the power plant will be down for a certain number of days or hours till the part shows up. How do you balance these two elements? I get back to workforce here. there is a big component, which is the workforce of a utility company is aging. And there was an article, I think, in New York Times talking about this subject. The average, I think, operator has been with a utility for 35 years or something like that. And most of these people are retiring. And, you know, I know most people don't want to send their children to work for a utility company nowadays. You know, they want to work for a computer company and do something exciting. How to deal with the workforce issues, hiring, training, what kind of impact will it have for the future? So there is lots of simulation that goes on here. This is a hot area, but I really don't know what the answer is. If nobody wants to go to work for a utility company, nobody will do it. But there are big issues for them. Emission trading, we talked about this one and its relationship to generation. And then the optimal operation of power plant, again, running the plant is not a trivial task. It's a very nonlinear system, and the question is how do you operate it to maximize your profit or minimize your cost? And the early problem detection that I mentioned earlier. Are there any questions before I move to the second part? And again, so far I've been describing the market, the energy business, okay. So in the U.S., there are 200 utilities, roughly speaking. However, the interaction is often localized, meaning you will see neighbors dealing with each other or one state away. But given the distance, the longer the distance you transmit power over, the more losses you have. So usually in a specific region, I don't know, it depends, but I think 10 players or so is a good ballpark. But again, in the U.S., there are 200 big players in that business. And they're highly regulated. Yes? Right. So that's, I agree. Modeling transmission is an important element, and I have very little expertise in it. In the case of transmission is an interesting area, because power will flow the way it likes to flow. In the sense, it will follow the path of least resistance. You cannot tell the power to go from here to Montreal to Vancouver. It will take the path of least resistance and it will follow that more or less. So there are issues with managing the transmission. There are many real-time control problems under transmission. I don't have expertise in this area. Yes? Correct. Right. So the deregulation mostly affected wholesalers. So in many cases in the U.S., and I think in many countries, the price for the end consumer is relatively well controlled or governed by them. Yes, in some cases. And your question, there should be a sudden decline or sudden jump? In principle, it should go down because it's becoming more competitive. Right. Second. Yeah, but do you know? I mean, definitely people say that deregulation not achieve its expected benefits. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly what's captured in this curve completely, like trade prices within the trades are taken. Lots of these prices are negotiated over long-term contracts, and I really don't know how the trades are accounted for in this chart. There are also changes in demand, as John mentioned, and there are also technological changes in the market. Right. Right. I think. Well, thanks. Yes. Yes. So, again, there is separation between generation and transmission. Again, the transmission is the highway, generation is where things are produced. The independent system operator is an entity that runs the transmission lines, again, in a fair fashion, all right? And there is a very complex set of things they do to make sure the system is reliable. So, for example, in California, at one point, they plan, for example, for the day ahead. So the way they do it is the following. They say, you know what, we expect the demand for the next 24 hours to be such, you know, 100 megawatt hour first hour, 150 next hour, so on and so forth. So they produce some sort of a schedule, usually hourly in the U.S. In the U.K., I think it's half hourly. They say, this is what we expect the demand to be over the next 24 hours or so, all right? Now, they post this information into people who are interested in bidding or producing power into the system. So now you have a generating unit, you look at the demand, and you bid saying, I want to supply 200 megawatt hours at this price, but you provide some sort of blocks or a curve saying, this is my production and that's the price by which I'm going to provide that production for the following hours. There are different flavors of the bidding mechanism, but in principle, it's you're providing your supply curve to the system. Now, the independent system operator will take this information and solve a large scale, could be integer or linear program, depending on the system they have, to determine what are the best bids to take into the system to accommodate my demand curve, all right? Usually, the last bid to be embedded, to be accepted into the system, that's what's called the clearing price. So some people may bid at $0, some people may bid at $1, $2. Let's say the $10 per megawatt hour was the winning price, or the last price we admitted. This would be the clearing price. So all the suppliers below that will be paid $10 per megawatt hour. The nice thing about this market design is it gives you an incentive to push your prices down. And often, if you look carefully at the bidding, nuclear units bid at zero for a variety of reasons. First, they're cheap, so they bid at zero to make sure they get into the system because they're going to be paid the clearing price, not their bidding price. The other thing, of course, they have to commit for a long period, so they have to be running. Okay? Gas units are more flexible, so they come what they call on margin, which is they play the game where to bid, and they can adjust up and down. Now, different markets have different designs. Some of them, for example, if you're committed for an hour, you have to be committed for a certain number of hours. Sometimes they can take you on and off. But that, so it's also an interesting bidding mechanism and how to design the market to accommodate the different bids. Yes. I'm not, do you know the answer? How many of them end up being fit? Yes. So 1-2% could be a reasonable number, but I really don't know. Any more questions? Okay, so it's a bit tricky now because this may, I'll rush a little bit in this one, but I can send you a paper or a related subject. Let's think of a utility company. Now they have their power units running, they have their demand, and they expect they have enough capacity to meet that demand. What I'm showing here is the demand curve. And again, remember, the units have a certain operating capacity. They can go between a lower bound and an upper bound, right? So that's really what you see in the red curve, the total capacity that the unit, the utility has, right? So it's impossible to track the curve 100%, right? Because again, the units are blocks of production. So the question they run into is the following. In the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, for that matter, this is the way it was described to me, they sit down and they say, you know what, I have this extra capacity that I could sell in the marketplace. Let's go and find people who are interested in bidding for this capacity. Okay, so they have a bulletin board or a website where they say, you know what, I have the following curve of production available. Who is interested in bidding for my capacity? Now, there are different buyers who are in the last minute, do not have enough capacity, or they trade or whatever they do, they decide, you know what, let me go and bid for that additional capacity. Now, of course, you could have multiple bidders bidding for this quantity. Now, a typical energy bid has two components, what's called capacity and energy. So when you bid for power, you say, I expect to use so much at most. So you provide some sort of a band or upper bound on how much you're going to consume, and that's called capacity. And then within that, when your demand occurs, you consume within that range. Okay, you cannot exceed it. If you exceed, there are very heavy penalties. You go within that range, and that's called energy charge. So that's sort of the true consumption you did. They charge you for that consumption. So there are two components to any energy contract. The capacity charge, which is just you're saying, I want to use at most so much, and they charge you for that amount, and then for the real amount you use. So people come back and they bid for capacity and energy, and when they bid, they say, I want so much capacity at this price and so much energy, and that's how much I'm going to pay for it. So that's the problem. Now, a large number of bidders submit these bids, and the question is, how do you choose these bids? Now, the producer has some knowledge of these players in the marketplace. So we have some distribution of their historical demand. So we know, for example, when they ask for a capacity of half a megawatt hour, this kind of producer, this kind of buyer has a certain profile, a certain distribution of that profile. So we could do some calculations based on that. The question is, how do you select the bids to maximize your profit? So I'm thinking of the problem in two stages. The first stage, I select the bids. So I accept or reject some of the bidders. And then in the second stage, things unfold and I determine how much money I'm going to make from their energy consumption. So in the first stage, I know I'm going to make their capacity charges. And in the second stage, I make the energy charges. So that's a simplified model of this problem. The first phase decision is a binary decision, 0-1, which is the XI, accept or reject. And then you get some additional revenue from the second stage, which is the QX function. Again, QX is how much money you're going to make from the power of that, from the true consumption of that individual. And it's here, by the way, where we're saying how much they consume Y megawatt hours over each time period. And K indicates the scenario. So I'm looking at the word in terms of scenarios. There is some sort of a scenario tree where they use a lot or they use a little, and each branch has a certain probability associated with it. And again, I want to make sure that whatever I sell them does not exceed their capacity that they reserved on the system. All right, so it's a very simple mathematical program in principle. There are two complications. The first one is that you have integer variables in the first stage, and the second complication, often in stochastic programming, often we ignore the role of robustness. In the sense that if you have a solution, you look at the expectation. What you'd like to do here is to embed some sort of variability measure that says, you know what, don't choose the best or the cheapest solution or the most profitable solution. Make sure you reduce the variance or you reduce some variability measure in the second stage. I don't want to make $1 million or lose $1 million. I'd rather make $100,000 to a $0. Okay, so that's some variability measure. It could be the variance of some other function. And lambda is a coefficient that's often used. Again, you want to if you make it zero, you get a typical stochastic program. If you increase it, you reduce your risk exposure. Now, so how do you solve this problem efficiently? That's the question I'm trying to address. Now, this what I showed earlier was a two-stage integer stochastic program with some variability measure or penalty. The way I'm going to go about it is in a couple of steps. First, let's take a quick look at two-stage stochastic linear programs. So there is no integrality and there is no penalty on the second stage. A typical two-stage stochastic program has this structure, and I'm not sure how much the audience knows about it. So first stage decision is CX, that's your cost, plus your expected value in the second stage. So QX is the cost. There is a number of scenarios. I'm denoting them by K, and probability with each scenario. and QKX is the cost of the second stage under scenario K, right? And again, QKX is itself is an optimization problem. We're trying to minimize some cost function with some constraints. The important thing is that your first stage decision X will affect your second stage, the feasible region of the second stage. So if you make, for if you decide to which contracts to choose in the third stage, this will determine which providers you're going to provide them with energy, which buyers. Now, in typical linear programming, if you take this problem, look at the KKT conditions carefully, you will find out that if I take these QKX, replace them by the objective of the second stage, I get what we call deterministic equivalent, which is, again, first stage, the objective of the second stage as an expectation, and all of the constraints put together. So this is a large problem where each scenario has its own set of constraints. You put the whole thing together, these two problems are equivalent to each other. Now, how do you solve this problem? Often, you decompose it. That's one of the traditional techniques for solving such problems. What I'm drawing here is, this is the X first stage variable, this is the second stage cost, okay? And you could, if you look carefully at the problem, it's a linear program where the right-hand side is changing, so you get some sort of a convex function of X. As X changes, the second stage cost draws a convex function. So a typical way of solving these kind of models is through decomposition. You take the first stage, you rewrite the first stage problem into the following. Cx, which is the objective of the first stage, plus C. C is some sort of an approximation of this function. And I will describe it in a moment. You have the constraints of the first stage problem, and then the constraints on C. The way it goes, assume you start at X here, and you have no constraints on C. You start with X, you look at the tangent or derivative or at this point, and you find, you know what, this is the slope. So you add a constraint that says C, which is, again, an approximation of this function, should be above that line. You optimize based on this function, and you end up with some point X2 here, probably. You go up, you find the derivative, and you add another constraint. So now your function is this cut plus that cut, that's your approximation. So now you have two constraints in the master problem. C is greater than the first cut and greater than the second cut. And when you solve, you get X3 at this point. You take, again, the derivative or the tangent, and you keep doing it till you converge. Okay, it's a standard practice in stochastic programming. The nice thing about it, that every K problem, you solve it separately, all right? So, are there any questions, or is that clear? In the case of the contract problem, usually we have 100 to 200 contracts. And, that's more or less what it is. So the real difficulty is, again, solving the first stage, which is the binary problem. The other complication is adding the variability measure, as I'm showing here. That's the problem we just looked at, and that's the equivalent of it. Again, remember, I'm taking QKX, just replacing it by its value. And these two are equivalent because the KKT conditions are the same. Everything is linear. However, if you add the variability measure, variance, for example, these two problems are not equivalent. I'll show a quick example of that. This is a very simple problem. Two scenarios. You have X is the first stage decision. Y1 and Y2 are the two scenarios, okay? Each one has probability of 0.5, objective function 1, so you get the objective function. The constraints are X plus YI greater than the right-hand side. Again, you have two scenarios. The first one is 3, the second one is 2, so these are the two constraints. And that's the problem we have. Now, if you take, for example, V, the variability measure, as being the variance, it has this form for this simple problem. If lambda is smaller than 1, now, if you look carefully at this problem, by the way, whatever X it is, so I make a decision in the first stage, my second stage decision has to be Y1 equals 3 minus X and Y2 equals 2 minus X. There is no other solution. It doesn't make sense. All right? If lambda is less than 1 and I solve this problem, I get Y1 equals 3, Y1 equals 2, and X is equal to 0. If I start pushing the penalty, what happens, you're forcing Y1 and Y2 to get closer to each other. Now, y1 is bounded below by 3 minus x, so it stays where it is. y2 starts to cheat and it goes away from the bound. So although x is 0, so y2 has to be 2, the optimization will push the bound higher, which doesn't make sense from a modeling standpoint. The reason is that the function you're choosing as your variability measure is not a good function. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to quickly go through this. You could show that you're losing optimality because the variability measure could go, that the subgradient of it could go positive or negative for some components. And one way to avoid that is by choosing variability measures that are increasing. So an example from finance is the following variability measure. You have target, R star, and you penalize yourself for not achieving that target. So for example, if you have a portfolio and you overachieve the return, that's fine. If you underachieve the return, you get penalized. In the case of contracts, the same, we're looking at cost here. If your cost is below the target, that's fine. If it's above the target, you get penalized. These are increasing functions, and you could show that you maintain optimality. Again, I have 2 minutes, so I'll skip over this, and I apologize. Let me go to the nonlinear, to the integer case. What I'm showing here is I can solve if the penalty measure is the penalty, if the variability measure is chosen carefully, then I could solve the problem efficiently. Efficiently meaning I do it exactly the same way as I did with a linear case, but I just have to scale the parameters or the multipliers. Now, how do you deal with the integer case where the first stage variables are binary? One way to do it is the following. You start at the root node where you're doing branch and bound, and you solve the root node by adding cuts, the same way I showed for the linear case. Then you start doing branching. So we use CPLEX for that one, actually. It keeps branching the usual way. When it reaches a node where the solution is integer, you go and you check, is this solution feasible with respect to, do we need a cut to make sure that we're getting the right objective function value? If the C function I showed is not the right approximation at that point, I add another cut to make the approximation correct. Okay? If it remains integer, that's fine. We fathom the node. If it's not integer, we keep the iteration. And I will stop by showing some examples. So this is a problem with 100 bids and 200 scenarios. Again, a scenario is a path of demand for the customer. I'm penalizing against some R star. Again, remember, if you're above that target, you get penalized. If you're below the target, you don't get penalized. And I'm showing here the performance of the algorithm. So at the root node, I add 368 cuts in some cases, more or less. Okay, and this is a very fast operation, usually, because it's a linear case. Then you start the branch and bound process. And again, the number of nodes could be pretty large, depending on how complicated the problem is. The interesting thing is, the stronger the penalty, it seems the problem takes less cuts. I have no way of explaining that, but numerical experience shows that. If you look at the CPU time, again, I'm running at most in 2 minutes, and that's a very average machine. It's a desktop Pentium. Okay, now in that case, the customer wanted to see a performance of 2, 3, 4 minutes, but no more than 5 minutes. So we could achieve that. And again, we're dealing with 100, 200 bids. And I'm showing some cost function. I apologize, I went through this quickly. So I'll stop here because it's 6 o'clock. Any questions?